Maryland sports fans, there's only one sports book in the great state of Maryland with over 50 years experience booking bets and supporting customers. Betfred Sportsbook at Long Shots is now open and is the only sports book in Frederick offering cash betting on football, basketball, world soccer, and more. Visit the Betfred Sportsbook at I-270 and MD-85 in Frederick, right next to Long Shots Off Track Betting. Go to BetfredSports.com for more information and your chance to win exclusive merchandise. Must be 21 or older. Play responsibly. For help, call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Welcome to the Inside Track, brought to you exclusively by Americana Rhythm Music Magazine. I am your host and publisher, Greg Tutwiler.
I am speaking today with Adam Gusso, an associate professor of English and Southern Studies at the University of Mississippi. Adam has just released a book, a novel actually, called Busker's Holiday. Welcome, Adam.
Thanks, Greg.
So glad just for clarification for anyone who's listening who might not know what the term busking means, just give me a quick layout of what that means to you and what we mean when we say busking.
Yeah, well, I mean, basically, it's interchangeable with the idea of street performing.
Mm-hmm.
And when my blues man partner, Sterling McGee, and I went off to the International Busker Fest in Halifax in the summer of 1990, we found ourselves, we were called Satan and Adam at that point. Mm-hmm. We found ourselves in the company of, jugglers and mimes and people who kind of stage street theater. Musicians are a part of that. One-man bands with the oom-pa-pa kinds of things on their back are part of that.
Mm-hmm.
So we were just, he was a one-man band and I was a harmonica player, and
yeah.
We kind of fit in. And okay. Those fanciful names are often part of the busking world.
Yeah.
I had not heard of the word busking in 1984 when I went off to Europe for the first time, and sort of which is the grounds of my novel. I certainly had seen street performers in New York. I'd seen jazz combos and stuff when I was working in a publishing company down by 59th Street and by the Plaza Hotel. So sort of the idea of street performance, back in the early 80s in New York, we had a guy named Ronaldo who was a beautiful Brazilian kind of sun god with long flowing locks and strumming big kind of classical guitar chords through amps and stuff. So they're all part of the busking world.
Sure.
And the key element of busking is really, I used to say there's three things that are important about it. You know, you got to get, it's the cop, the location, the cops, and the weather. You've got to be centrally located enough, there has to be enough street traffic that people going by, that there's a chance that somebody will actually see you and throw money at you.
Mm-hmm.
The cops have to leave you alone,
mm-hmm.
As opposed to saying, you know, as they do in New York when you try to play at the corner of Central Park West,
mm-hmm.
Columbus Circle, they'll sort of point up and they'll go, no, the people up there are going to complain the moment you start. No amps,
okay,
you know.
Okay.
And the weather, you know, if it rains,
yeah, sure.
What do busters do?
Yeah.
So,
okay.
Street performance.
So the idea of busker we've got. The book is Busker's Holiday, and it's a novel, but it's based on your experience. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yes, and it's a novel that I was moved to try to begin to write, interestingly enough, 31 years ago when I, as a 26-year-old, first kind of, I was a graduate student at Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
I was in a long-term relationship that ended, and you've got a couple of different choices when that happens. You can go quietly crazy. You can see a therapist.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have money for a therapist, I suppose you can go off to Europe and busk. And
that was
kind of, I took the latter plan. I think if I'd had inpatient counseling, none of this would have happened. But but I went off with a buddy in 84 and came back after 5 weeks, turned inside out. And I think, you know, the novel, I'll talk in a minute about sort of how it got written, but I came back and I was so powerfully changed and transformed. I still can't quite make sense of it, except to say that these many years later, I'm a professor who's sort of teaching blues literature and I'm playing a lot of music still. It changed the guy that I was from a book guy to a book guy who acknowledged that he was a crazy, serious musician down underneath. And I think busking can do that. It can pull those things out of you. And I don't know, I was getting started and then I just sort of lost the train of thought. It was based, so it, I went to Europe and I came back and I said, I'm going to be like Jack Kerouac on the Kerouac model. I sat down and I wrote 40 pages a week for 14 weeks.
Wow. Okay.
And I came up with a crappy, big, sprawling first novel that was utterly unpublishable. And it took me a year to figure that out. And then I went back and said, I need to learn how to write. I was a good writer, but not a good fiction writer.
Mm-hmm.
But after another 3 years, and several more trips to Europe, including the summer of 86, when I went and worked it for a couple of months, and then quite a bit of playing in New York. I mean, my experience as a busker was not just going over to Europe and doing it. It was working with several different guys in New York on the streets. And then a long partnership with a guy named Sterling McGee, who I met on the streets of Harlem as Mr. Satan.
Hmm.
So for any of your listeners who might say, well, who is this Adam Gusso guy? If you've ever seen Rattle and Hum, the U2 movie,
sure.
There's one brief scene where you've got basically a bearded older black guy playing guitar and a couple of hi-hat cymbals, and there's a white guy in a white cowboy hat. That's me.
Okay.
That was the summer of 87, and U2 came by, and they were looking for the roots in American music, you know. And they found us, and we ended up in Rattle and Hum in 1988. And played 5 years part-time on the street in New York, and then got picked up by, we were playing a lesbian bar in Greenwich Village, and I got picked up by Bo Diddley's manager. She said, hey, I manage the Village People, Bo Diddley and Wilson Pickett, and I love what you guys are doing.
That's cool.
Thereby teaching a lesson that any musician should learn, which is you never know what gig is going to be the gig.
Yeah.
You never know who's in the audience.
And
suddenly we're on the bus with Bo. And so I had that whole experience. And during that whole period of time, late 80s, early 90s, I was writing what ended up becoming the core of Busker's Holiday.
Okay.
So, yes, a lot of busking experience. And I still play on the streets.
So why a novel instead of a biographical story? All of that sounds very interesting in and of itself. Why the fiction aspect to it?
Well, and that's a good question. And, you know, the interesting thing is that I did, in fact, write a memoir about my whole Harlem experience and some of the background that made it into Busker's Holiday. And that was called Mr. Satan's Apprentice, a blues memoir. And that's still on the market. It's still out there. Busker's Holiday was the one that I was trying to write before that. And you say, why? I'm going to give a name. The novel's really, you know, it's invented, but it's based in things that happened. I would say that one of the core motives for writing the novel was to honor the very first guy that I played with on the street. He was a guitar player. I suspect that a few of your audience may know him, but most probably won't. But he's easy to find. If you Google Bill Taft, the president won't come up first. So basically a kind of wild, surrealist, neo-folk guy who lives in Atlanta. We're still friends. And I sent him the book. He knows. I said, Bill, you know, I wanted to create a character who you were for me back then. And so the character Billy Lee Grant, who's this 21-year-old kind of crazy Dylan-esque, like he's like Tom Waits, Bob Dylan, and early Muddy Waters all jammed in the body of one college grad, who just is, he's sort of American wild-heartedness personified, plays guitar left-handed, and just talks in 10 different voices like W.C. Fields and everything else. And that's who this guy is. And that's in the core of my novel. Well, a lot of that's invention. But it's so I had to write a novel. I had to do fiction in order to imagine what would happen if this a young version of me, McKay Chernoff, met Bill, young Bill, in Europe, and they decided they were going to lay waste to the European summer busking scene. So that's the premise of the novel, the middle part of the novel.
Okay, that's cool. And how did all of that experience bring you to be a professor of English and Southern Studies?
Well, you know, I used to joke back. I was a grad student at Columbia in the early 80s after working in publishing a little bit. I was a grad student between 82 and 84, and then that change of life happened, and I hung in for another year and then just left. I used to joke that like Raskolnikov and Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment, I was a former grad student. I took great pride in the idea that I had just left. and I don't know, you know, again, people listening to this, most of them probably aren't college professors, and some might think that's a sort of strange thing for a musician to do. Actually, you know, you get summers off and you have Christmas vacation, spring breaks.
Sure.
And if you want to be a musician, it's a pretty good day gig, and I really hope the chair of my department doesn't hear this. It's a good gig to have, especially if you're doing what I do, which is teaching English and Southern Studies, and specifically teaching blues literature.
Okay.
So that's what I was brought down to Ole Miss to do. I bring blues musicians into my classroom. Mark Muleman Massey and Bill Howland Mad Perry. I also teach a course in a Southern Studies course that's called Southern Musicians Autobiographies.
Okay.
And so we do everybody from Loretta Lynn and Johnny Cash to the High Lonesome Sound. We definitely do some bluegrass stuff in class. So that's, I think what happened was, I'm like many people, I've got different sides. There's the side that likes to sit and get lost in a story, and there's a side that likes to, you know, talk about what's happening when that happens. And I like the challenge of trying to talk about something like blues, from all different perspectives. In fact, I organized some conferences here early on. You know, not just as a practitioner where you're talking about the three-hole draw and how to bend and get that sort of slightly higher than flat third note off the three-hole.
Mm-hmm.
But also, what does that mean? Why? Where does that tonality come from?
Yeah.
And who uses it how? So when you start talking about something like blues, and the same is true of bluegrass, it gets you into American social history and African-American history and that whole Creole thing, which makes American music so entrancing to people overseas, you know.
What would the typical student be studying that finds themselves in the classes that you teach?
Well, I'm teaching my course English 324 in the spring. So when I say blues literature, I'm going to start them off by just reading some definitions and some sort of epigrams when blues musicians talk about what the blues are. We'll read the three H's, Langston Hughes, W.C. Handy, and Zora Neale Hurston.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got in Hughes, you've got a great blues poet who took that 12-bar AAB form and found a way of cutting the lines in half and making little six-line blues poems. And we'll talk about what it means to take vernacular American music and translate it into literature. What do you leave out? You don't have the harmonica player responding to the line, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's no fills.
Mm-hmm.
So as a musician, I mean, I bring the insights that a practicing musician might have into class. W.C. Handy writes a book called Father of the Blues, and so we think about what does it mean to be a kind of middle-class son and grandson of black ministers. What does it mean to fall in love with the blues? It turns out it was as tricky for him as it would have been for a white peer. You know, popular music was not something that the black middle class liked. They thought of it as sort of minstrelsy.
And these students are pursuing what type of degree?
The students that I get would be a certain number would be English majors.
Okay.
There might be some field of interest. Yeah, so they're undergrads. And they're Mississippi kids. They're much more white than not.
Mm-hmm.
They tend to be in these classes, although the University of Courts is now very integrated. But, you know, it tends to be the white kids more who are interested in the blues.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And Southern Studies students, but there might be some from any different undergraduate degree. I've had business majors, science majors. So.
Okay, yeah, that's interesting.
You
and I have spoken a couple times about a topic that seems to be touching many forms of music, not just the blues, bluegrass as well, and I think more vividly for probably a broader audience, even country music, and that's the idea of the traditional sound versus this modern sound that seems to be encroaching and in some areas consuming what people have perceived as being the authentic sound. So we may be starting a topic that we can't finish this afternoon, but you've mentioned that this is a topic that's kind of important to you, and you've got some insight. Mm-hmm. So let's go down that path a little bit.
Yeah, well, this is a place where, you know, I tell your listeners that in a sense I'm kind of moving in a slightly parallel universe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm a blues guy with sort of jazz and funk leanings. The busking thing takes me into a folk direction, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
But I rarely find myself in bluegrass context. I'd be sort of frightened. My friend Trip Henderson would. I mean, I know harmonica players who play bluegrass.
Yeah.
But you know, in the contemporary blues world, you have a very interesting phenomenon, which is to say that, and this has been especially true among, because there's a kind of racial component to this, among white blues players.
Mm-hmm.
There's sort of, it goes in two different directions. One is a kind of intense, what I'd call a traditionalist approach that makes a fetish of a certain kind of sound, and it's either, you know, the country sound of blues circa 1920, 1930 with Robert Johnson and, mm-hmm. and you know, Son House being kind of fetish objects,
mm-hmm.
The way that, let's say, somebody with hardcore just wants to do, you know, the Bluegrass Boys, Bill Monroe mm-hmm. repertoire might fall into that category.
Mm-hmm.
But again, so white guys singing with pseudo-black accents,
mm-hmm.
they also might get into kind of a 50s retro bag and want to all be just like Little Walter.
Mm-hmm.
The other extreme, of course, would be a kind of futurism and would be sort of the heavy rock end.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also a thing that's out there. It's very hard, I think, for blues to figure out, to kind of navigate the tensions between tradition and what I call modernity, between mm-hmm. the old sound and whatever a new sound might be.
Mm-hmm.
The great irony is that a guy like Little Walter, who any number of modern blues harmonica players want to sound just like, a guy like Little Walter was incredibly invested in trying to sound not like everybody else. Well, he wanted to sound like the sax players, the hip contemporary R&B sax players.
Mm-hmm.
If I tried to sound like Dave Sanborn, which is a guy I've listened to,
mm-hmm.
I listen to a lot of sax players as a harp player, but it would be like, I mean, Dave Sanborn at this point is, I mean, he's not cutting edge
right.
the way he was in the mid-80s.
Right.
But so there's this tension, and my own perspective on this, I often come off as a kind of modernist. I often come off as somebody who likes to get down on the traditionalists
mm-hmm.
because I think that what they're doing is sort of reifying a particular catalog, a particular sound, but not really honoring the spirit that was there in the people who created all this wonderful music,
mm-hmm.
like a Robert Johnson, who mm-hmm. was, again, in his own way, kind of cutting edge.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He was not, you know, he's not the old sound in 1936 exactly. He's really trying to, some of his Hot Tamales and Red Hots, yeah, we got them for sale. He's
mm-hmm.
doing contemporary kind of street art.
Mm-hmm.
My own attitude was formed by the fact that I played with an elder African-American musician who was an incredible innovator. He was from Mississippi, played with King Curtis, was in Germany as a paratrooper during the 50s. He was incredibly hip and incredibly devoted. He said, I don't sound like anybody else. He said, the hardest thing in the world is to get a sound that nobody else has.
Mm-hmm.
So he was a radical innovator, but by the same token, coming from Mississippi as he did, had a deep, soulful Southern sound.
Sure, yeah.
And that makes me, and he pulled me along with him. He dragged me along. And that means my own approach tends to be half a foot in tradition and half, you know, 1 foot in tradition and mm-hmm. 1 foot in
mm-hmm.
trying to do stuff that will sound in 50 years like it was the sound of 2015,
yeah,
if that makes any sense.
Sure.
I don't know where that lays me relative to the contemporary bluegrass world. Maybe you can, I'd like to hear a little bit from your perspective, if it's not too dangerous for you.
No, not at all. I mean, I think it's, that divide has been happening in very visually in the national country music scene for quite a while. You've mm-hmm. you've got a lot of people who are traditional country music lovers who like the Waylon Jennings and Merle Haggard and Kitty Wells and Dottie West mm-hmm. and that type of sound. And then you've got the new country music of today that to me sounds a lot like the kind of the 70s FM 70s classic rock music. It's got very, very much
yeah.
that kind of sound. What seems to be kind of happening in the bluegrass industry is you have a lot of folks that are kind of really leaning in towards the preservation of the traditional sound, you know, the Bill Monroe type approach to bluegrass music, and then you've got the Sam Bush era type folks who they call that newgrass, and mm-hmm. then on up into the experimental, which really rolls over into the Americana, which they don't mind adding a little bit of percussion, and you may even see a little harp showing up from time to time. It's still bluegrass instruments.
The Bella Fleck and the Flecktones, I suppose.
Sure, yeah, yeah, right.
Continue.
Yeah, so it's leaving. The same kind of struggle with, you've got the musicians really wanting to hold on to the traditional sound, and then you've got the newer, predominantly newer, younger musicians who are very much appreciate the influence of the traditional sound, but are trying to establish their own sound that, kind of like you said, in 50 years when you look back, you know, when you look back to the 30s, you will see that Bill Monroe as being identified mm-hmm. as a bluegrass sound. When you look back to the 2015s, you may look more like into the Steep Canyon Rangers or the Flecktones or somebody like that as kind of being the ones that have established the benchmark for that era. So it's the same kind of thing, but I think probably you would have people in the jazz industry say the same thing. You've got the classic jazz artists that Coltrane and those folks, and then you've got the new more fusion jazz that, again, you kind of got that divide. Like,
yeah,
you know, how do we hang
point.
On to the old and still create authentic new music?
Good point. I wonder what the Americana rhythm audience would make of, I'm trying to remember his name, but it was Chris Stapleton and what's his name, the guy from Memphis?
Sure, yeah, the guy who just won 3 awards at the CMAs.
But what was the, I'm not a huge CMA guy, but I was watching, and why am I forgetting his name? Who's the
Chris
young
Stapleton,
white soul guy?
Justin Timberlake?
Justin Timberlake.
Yeah,
some of the best music I've heard on live TV
in
the last 20 years.
Yeah.
I was blown away. Now,
yeah.
You know, so you want to know where I'm coming from, it would be, that's something I've never heard before.
Right, and it was very good and rooted in kind of the classic country sound, but Chris Stapleton is a phenomenal songwriter.
He is
a Kentucky bluegrass roots artist and spent a couple years with a group called the Steel Drivers, and they were nominated a couple times for Grammy Awards. So he's established himself actually in the bluegrass industry. And so a lot of the country music folks, like, who is this guy? We've never heard of him before, but he's written 8 or 10 top number one songs, even quite a few of them for other country artists. So it was really
I loved the two songs that those two guys did together.
Yeah,
I literally stood up with the hair rising on my head going, what is this? It was like deep Southern soul with all that stuff mixed together. So to me, that's, you know, when you can do that, so you want to know what somebody kind of outside the central orbit of Americana rhythm, you know, is looking for in terms of crossover, it would be that kind of unexpected blend, but it has to have something deep in it.
I
think he clearly did. Yeah.
That was awesome. Yeah. Everybody that I know has kind of had the same feeling, like, man, that's where it needs to go. And so, yeah, you know, it'll be neat to see what kind of run he has with that exposure.
Well, you know, I've always been a fan of Alison Krauss from the old days.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I listened to Channel 61, Sirius XM, the Bluegrass Channel, which is how I was aware that there was a big tension with, you know, between modernists and traditionalists within bluegrass. It was one of my favorite stations.
So the book is Busker's Holiday. How can people find that? Where's the best place for them to get a copy?
So, you know, well, the easiest thing to do, I suppose, is go to Google and put in Busker's Holiday. And if you do that, the first page that comes up is a page on my website, Modern Blues Harmonica, in which you can either buy from Amazon or you can buy direct from me.
Okay.
The truth is, I didn't think I really wanted to be a book fulfillment, you know, agency.
Yeah.
But Amazon has at this point is not. They've got the e-books if you're an e-book person,
okay.
But they don't yet have the actual books. So I'm sort of filling the gap.
Okay.
So it depends what you want. You can go directly to Amazon, but you can also come right to me.
And how can they reach out to you directly if they're curious to tap into some more of these kinds of conversations or find out more about you personally?
Well, am I allowed to give an email address on
it? Yeah, absolutely, sure.
Sure. It's easy to find me. It's asgussow, ASGUSSOW at AOL.com. Easy to find, and I'm also at the University of Mississippi. It's easy to find me there on the webpage. I've got a website called Modern Blues Harmonica, which sort of has very active forum for people who are interested in harmonica stuff.
Great.
And lots of stuff on YouTube. Anybody who is looking to maybe take a first step and learn how to play blues harmonica, you can just Google Gusso harmonica on YouTube and you'll find more than you want to find.
Great.
A lot there.
Great. Thanks, Adam. This has been neat. I think we've probably opened up some conversations we may have to pursue again sometime. So this has been cool. Thanks for sharing with us.
Well, I really appreciate the time and space, Greg. Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to another edition of The Inside Track. We sure do appreciate you sticking around. Join us again real soon when we get together with another great artist and talking about their music. Have a great day.
Maryland sports fans, there's only one sports book in the great state of Maryland with over 50 years experience booking bets and supporting customers. Betfred Sportsbook at Longshots is now open and is the only sports book in Frederick offering cash betting on football, basketball, world soccer, and more. Visit the Betfred Sportsbook at I-270 and MD-85 in Frederick, right next to Longshots off-track betting. Go to BetfredSports.com for more information and your chance to win exclusive merchandise. Must be 21 or older. Play responsibly. For help, call 1-800-GAMBLER.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more Fantasy Points.